Hallo zusammen, hier ist Erik. Bevor es mit der Folge losgeht, ein rascher Hinweis in eigener Sache. Wenn ihr unsere Arbeit schätzt, und zwar ob nun den Weltwach-Podcast oder auch unsere anderen Shows, Reiseflops, Tierisch oder auch die Weltwach-Klangreise, und wenn ihr uns unterstützen möchtet oder wenn ihr auch einfach nicht genug Weltwach bekommen könnt, für all diese Fälle habe ich gute Nachrichten für euch. Und ihr ahnt es vielleicht schon, ich spreche vom Weltwach Supporters Club. Als Mitglied des Weltwach Supporters Clubs erhaltet ihr Zugriff auf die regulären Folgen des Weltwach Podcasts, und zwar ohne Werbung unserer Sponsoren. Und ihr erhaltet ab dem zweiten Paket Zugriff auf sämtliche Folgen von mittlerweile ganzen 3 exklusiven Showformaten. Erstens der Klassiker Weltwach Plus. Mittlerweile haben wir da viele Dutzend Folgen mit Weltwachfreunden wie Christine Thürmer, Andreas Altmann, Michael Martin und so weiter, aber auch mit vielen Gästen, die ihr noch nicht aus der regulären Show kennt. Das zweite Exklusivformat ist Weltwach Extrem. Hier erzählen unsere Gäste von ihren denkwürdigsten, das heißt also schönsten, gefährlichsten, furchtbarsten und so weiter, Momenten unterwegs. Mehrere Supporter haben uns auch schon gemailt, dass das definitiv ihr neues Lieblings-Weltwach-Format ist. Das freut mich natürlich sehr. Und schließlich unser drittes Exklusivformat, Weltwach Backstage. Hier geben wir vom Weltwach-Team euch einen Einblick hinter die Kulissen unserer Arbeit. Alle Infos zur Mitgliedschaft findet ihr auf weltwach.de unter Supporters Club. Dort erklären wir, wie ihr über die Plattform Steady eine Mitgliedschaft abschließen könnt und wie ihr Zugriff auf euren exklusiven Supporter-Podcast-Feed erhaltet, mit dem ihr dann die werbefreien und auch die Bonusfolgen hören könnt. Und wenn ihr zum Podcast hören Spotify benutzt, dann könnt ihr auch gern einfach in der Spotify-App nach Weltwach Supporters Club suchen und dort direkt eine Mitgliedschaft abschließen. Ihr werdet dann zu Steady weitergeleitet. Ist ganz einfach. All das gibt es, wie gesagt, übersichtlich auf weltwach.de unter Supporters Club. Wir danken allen Unterstützerinnen und Unterstützern von Herzen. Ihr tragt mit dazu bei, unsere Arbeit zu ermöglichen, und wir werden uns weiterhin darum bemühen, euch im Gegenzug fantastische, exklusive Zusatzinhalte anzubieten für noch mehr Weltwach, noch mehr Abenteuer, noch mehr Reiselust und noch mehr Wissen über unseren faszinierenden Planeten. Dankeschön.
New Guinea is a microcosm. At a distance, when I'm not there in the jungle with the leeches crawling over me and with mosquitoes biting me and itching from all these scrub bites, when I'm not there and I think about New Guinea at a distance, I think of it as the most beautiful, fascinating place in the world.
Grenzgänger und leidenschaftliche Weltenwanderer nehmen uns mit auf ihre Streifzüge und bieten Einblicke in ferne Orte und faszinierende Kulturen. Mit offenen Augen ins Abenteuer. Das ist der Weltwach-Podcast mit Erik Lorenz.
Weltwach-Stammgast Andreas Altmann macht sich gelegentlich darüber lustig, dass ich ihn in den frühen Folgen von Weltwach allzu großspurig angekündigt habe, als einen der erfolgreichsten, der besten, der tollsten Reiseschriftsteller Deutschlands. Ich glaube zwar eigentlich, dass er sich ja insgeheim darüber freut, aber ja, er hat schon recht, ne? Also mit Superlativen sollte man sich etwas vorsehen, das habe ich mittlerweile auch gelernt. Nichtsdestotrotz, ich muss es sagen, wie es ist, in dieser Folge haben wir, nach meinem bescheidenen Dafürhalten jedenfalls, einen Giganten zu Gast. Einen wissenschaftlichen Tausendsasser, den diverse britische und amerikanische Magazine zu einem der weltweit 10 wichtigsten Intellektuellen gewählt haben und der zu so ziemlich allem forscht und schreibt, was die menschliche Existenz ausmacht. Stichwort Universalgenie. Seine einzige Schwäche ist Technologie. Das hat er im kurzen Vorgespräch auch unumwunden zugegeben.
Scott, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
It's good to meet you. I apologize for your having to cope with someone technologically equivalent to a 4-year-old child.
Ja gut, also ganz so schlimm ist es natürlich nicht, aber richtig ist, dass aus diesem Grund die Audioqualität dieses Mal leider nicht ganz so gut ist wie gewohnt. Drückt da bitte mal ein Auge zu und lasst euch davon nicht abhalten. Ich habe Jared Diamond im Vorgespräch dann gefragt, ob, abgesehen vom gescheiterten Versuch, ein externes Mikrofon anzuschließen, das ich ihm extra geschickt hatte, ob ansonsten technisch alles klar sei. Seine Antwort?
Well, did you see the that wonderful film Das Boot? About German U-boats in World War II?
Yes, I did, many years ago.
Okay, it begins with the captain addressing the crew, and the first thing he says to the crew, after explaining absolutely nothing to them, is, "Ist alles klar?" Yes, everything is clear. Alles klar.
Okay, das klingt doch vielversprechend. Alles ist klar, Jared Diamond ist bereit, loszulegen. Bevor es losgeht, aber nun noch rasch ein paar weitere Infos zu ihm. Jared Diamond studierte Physiologie in Harvard und Cambridge und wurde ein führender Experte für die Gallenblase. Er ist außerdem Ornithologe, Anthropologe, Soziologe, Evolutionsbiologe, Ökologe und Umwelthistoriker mit Fachkenntnissen in Archäologie, Genetik und Epidemiologie menschlicher Krankheiten. Zudem ist er Professor für Geographie in Los Angeles. Ja, und dann ist er auch noch einer der erfolgreichsten Autoren populärwissenschaftlicher Sachbücher überhaupt. Seine Werke wurden in rund 40 Sprachen übersetzt und für den Weltbestseller Guns, Germs and Steel, The Fates of Human Society, die deutsche Ausgabe heißt Arm und Reich, die Schicksale menschlicher Gesellschaften, wurde er 1998 mit dem Pulitzer-Preis ausgezeichnet. Zu seinen anderen Büchern gehören, ich nehme jetzt mal nur die deutschen Titel, Kollaps, warum Gesellschaften überleben oder untergehen, Vermächtnis, was wir von traditionellen Gesellschaften lernen können und sein aktuelles Werk Krise, wie Nation sich erneuern können. Und ich muss, glaube ich, nicht darauf hinweisen, wie relevant und aktuell ein solcher Umgang mit Krisen derzeit leider ist. Bei alledem ist Jared Diamond nicht nur ein Meister der Laborarbeit und der Literaturrecherche, sondern er ist und war auch selbst unterwegs in der ganzen Welt. Er war zum Beispiel allein über 30 Mal auf Neuguinea und er spricht über ein Dutzend Sprachen fließend. Also ihr merkt schon, mehr als genug Stoff für ein facettenreiches Gespräch über eine einzigartige wissenschaftliche Karriere und über die Welt, in der wir leben. Wir sprechen darüber, was er von den Stämmen in den Regenwäldern von Neuguinea gelernt hat, über die größten Gefahren, die der Menschheit und der Erde heute drohen und über vieles mehr. Also werft eure Hirne an, und los geht's. Hi, Mr. Diamond. Welcome to our show. Thank you so much for making the time.
You are welcome.
It's really great to talk to you from LA to LA. The city is, of course, your home and it has become my home in the past year. But when preparing for this conversation, I also realized that you used to live in my original home in Germany for quite a while, quite some time ago. What do you personally associate with Germany?
What do I associate with Germany? So many things. The German language. I had my best teacher in university was my German teacher. I loved the German language. People speak of the German language as being guttural, unattractive. No, Hochdeutsch, spoken on the Bühne, it is one of the most beautiful languages. So that's one thing. Another thing, German music. I'm musical. Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Schubert, Mozart. And I had the good fortune that when I was living in München in 1961, Hans Hörter was the director of the Bavarian State Opera, and he was singing Wotan in the Ring. So great musical experiences. My German friends, my beloved German friends, whom I've known for, 65 years now, and mountain climbing, and German beer, the best beer in the world, of course, close to Andex, south of München, and the best wine in the world, Egenmüller Schatzhof beer. So all those reasons why I love Germany.
Well, that's quite a lot, including, I just want to remark, mountain climbing and the German language, which I especially appreciate, as my husband is Chinese, and he always makes a little bit of fun of how harsh German sounds. Well, I actually also love the language, so I appreciate it. And I know that you know our language quite well. You speak it very well as well. So that's great to hear. Well, since then, you have studied and written, as we have mentioned, it's quite a few years ago since you lived in Germany. You have written and studied many, many topics. And I've known and appreciated you for quite some years now as the author, for example, of Collapse and, of course, of Guns, Germs and Steel. In preparation of this interview, however, I have to admit I was surprised that these are not the topics that you have spent your whole career with. And initially, you were mainly known as a gallbladder expert. As far as I understand it, you were one of the world's five leading experts, in fact, on the gallbladder. But among the scientific community as a whole, you were, or maybe even are, probably even better known for your work on birds, which, of course, is yet another topic. And this indicates to me that your scientific interests have quite a broad scope. How did you get fascinated by science itself in the first place? How did it all start for you?
In childhood, my mother was a linguist, a talented linguist. She was also a concert pianist. So from my mother, I learned my love of languages and also piano playing. My father was a physician, a medical researcher. And so growing up, whenever people asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? My routine answer was, I want to be a doctor like my father. And then I started bird watching when I was 7 years old. So in secondary school, because I expected to become a doctor and go to medical school, I figured I'd be doing science for the rest of my life. And so in secondary school, I had the good fortune to go to a great secondary school where there were language courses and history courses. And so I didn't take any science in school. I instead took lots of history and language. In college, I did take the pre-medical courses, but the absolute minimum. And I took as many courses as possible in other areas. I took intensive Russian. My first semester, I took German literature. I started off with Thomas Mann, Mario und der Zauberer, which begins with one sentence that lasts 2.5 pages. So it was in my senior year in college that I finally realized I had to confront, do I want to be a doctor? No. And so at the last minute, the next fallback to going to medical school was to do medical research in laboratory physiology. And so I went to Cambridge, England for 4 years to get my PhD. I began working on the gallbladder because, as you have already discovered, I'm technologically incompetent. The gallbladder is a simple sack. It required no more technology than a balance for weighing the gallbladder. And yes, I became the world's number one expert on salt and water transport in the gallbladder, for which I got appointed professor of physiology at University of California, Los Angeles Medical School. That was my job, but I developed a parallel career at the same time doing field research on New Guinea birds. And so for decades, I had my laboratory research, my New Guinea bird research, and then finally, at the time of a career crisis we'll get to, I closed my laboratory and switched to the geography department at UCLA.
Which is yet another topic. Yeah, we'll get to that. Why did you love birds so much? How did your passion for these species start?
Most field biologists get drawn to a group of species, not rationally, but by chance. For example, people who study lizards tend to be people who have difficulty waking up in the morning and they don't get active until 10 or 11 in the morning when the sun comes up. People who study bats tend to be people who stay up at night. In the case of birds, people who study birds, they tend to be people of high metabolism, nervous like me. And also to study birds, birds use the same senses that we do. They communicate by sight and by sound, but I'm musical, so identifying birds by song comes easily to me. And also, I have good vision. So birds, they came easily to me. And I've attempted to get interested in other groups of animals. I've tried to get interested in fish and in plants and in trees, but they just don't do it for me.
That's an interesting response that you say, basically the researchers, the scientists tend to be kind of similar to the animals they do research on. What does that tell us about, for example, researchers being specialized in sloths or panda bears, like really lazy animals?
I have not personally known any sloth biologist, but I can tell you that the college classmate who introduced me and my wife is one of the world's authorities on bats. He's the person who worked out the electrophysiology of echolocation in bats. And Alan is someone who gets up a little late in the morning and he is at his best after midnight, like bats.
You said once in another interview that you also like birds because they are able to fly away from their problems. Would you like to be able to do that too sometimes?
Oh, of course, yeah. As a child, I found so many things frustrating and difficult. But birds fly. They can fly away. And so when I have dreams and fantasies, I'm flying. I just skip over problems. I admire birds for their ability to solve problems just by taking flight.
Yes, so these are already two pretty distinct specializations, the gallbladder and birds. And to do science about either of them on your level would be, I believe, more than enough for any lifelong academic career. Yet somehow, for you and your curiosity, even this seemingly was not enough, and you somehow ended up in the Department of Geography. You already hinted at it in your university. How did that happen?
I started, actually, with geography. I was born in 1937, mm-hmm. and so I grew up in World War II. And that meant that on the wall of my bedroom, my father pasted up two maps. There was a map of the European theater, war theater, and a map of the Pacific war theater. Each day, Dad moved the pins on the maps to show the shifting battle lines. So I grew up with geography literally in my face. Then my first trip to Europe was in 1950, when there was still food rationing and bombed out sites in London. And then when I came to live in Europe in 1958 to 1962, and my European friends were British and German and Russian and Serbo-Croat, but their lives were different from mine. My best friend in Germany watched his father's house being bombed, and his wife, another of my best friends in Germany, her father, she didn't know because he went off to fight when she was in utero. My British friends, again, watched bombing. My Austrian friend, two of his brothers died, and one of them he didn't know until 3 years after the end of the war. So all of these differences, I had had a sheltered life. My European friend, just because of accidents of geography, because they'd been born in München or London or Moscow, their lives have been very different from my life. So that brought it home to me that the accidents of geography affect one's life. And then when I went to work in New Guinea in 1964, my New Guinea friends, they'd been using stone tools. And I went out there naively thinking, what is their problem mentally that I was the person coming in there with metal tools, they had stone tools? But it took me about a day to discover the New Guineans are at least as smart as Americans and Europeans. Why is it that they ended up with the stone tools and I ended up with the metal tools? And it took me decades to figure that out. That was my book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. But those are examples of why geography impressed me from early on.
And I believe an important ingredient, or in addition to all these thoughts and experiences that you just mentioned, stemmed also from your sons, that really sparked your in-depth thinking about geography and politics and geopolitics to an even greater extent around, I don't know, the millennium?
Right. So in people's lives, there are turning points, and some of them are sudden and some of them are slow. A turning point in my life was the birth of my wife's and my twin sons just short of my 50th birthday. Until my twin sons were born, I had written about environmental problems. I knew that the projection is that the tropical rainforest, where I work in New Guinea, that most of the tropical rainforest will be destroyed if we continue in our way by the year 2050. But because I was born in 1937, I'm not going to see the end of the rainforest. It was unreal to me. It was a world problem. I knew it was a world problem, but it was an unreal problem that would never affect me. And then when my kids were born in 1987, I realized, Max and Joshua, in 2050, they'll be 63 years old. They'll be at the peak of their lives, and their lives are not going to be affected by gallbladders. Their lives are going to be affected by the state of the world in 2050. So, Jared, isn't it about time that you start doing something for the state of the world in 2050? So it was the birth of my sons that triggered me to write books for the general public about the state of the world.
What I find interesting is that in an interview, you said that in retrospect, the best years of your life have been your 70s. Why is that? Is that because you broadened the focus of your work from gallbladders and birds to an even greater extent?
You will see when you reach 70 that with luck, provided that you do not get derailed by a car accident, as I did not, the significance of becoming 70 is that the likelihood is for people in first world society with good medical care in your 70s, you'll still be healthy, but in your 70s, you'll have satisfied many of your life ambitions. You won't be driven by the need to prove yourself. Perhaps you'll be doing the things that you're best at, and you'll have the opportunity to do what you're best at. So I would say, in retrospect, in my 70s, there were not yet physical problems developing, but I was already happy and peaceful and satisfied in life and doing what I wanted to do.
And what you wanted to do is, besides many other things, and you already mentioned that as well, writing books. So not only doing research and writing for the scientific community, but for the broad public. What drove your desire to do that?
Again, it was the birth of my sons. Mm-hmm. My first book, The Third Chimpanzee, Der Dritte Schimpanse, was about how we humans differ from other animals, our closest relatives, and we differ in the fact that we have language, that we have art, but animals have art, that we affect the environment, but animals affect the environment. In The Third Chimpanzee, I had chapters on how we humans in the past have destroyed our environments and how we're at risk of destroying the environments today. So The Third Chimpanzee was the first of my, and was dedicated to my twin son. So that book was the first of my books trying to motivate people to make the world of the year 2050 a world in which my sons will and their generation will lead a happy life rather than a ruined life.
This was your first book, and I think it's safe to say that a red thread that weaves through all of your books is that you write a lot about the past, but that one of your main motivations behind all of this is to deliver messages and knowledge for the present and the future. You have already hinted at the fact that, for example, climate change is one of such challenges that we are facing. What would you say, generally speaking, and maybe that's an obvious question, but I still would like to talk about it briefly, why and how is a sound understanding of science essential for the broad public in order, for example, to deal with such challenges?
Science is nothing more than perceiving reality and understanding reality. Reality includes being healthy, having a good diet, having good relations with people, doing what you want to in life. If you don't think scientifically, you're messing up your view of the world. And so many Americans mess up their view of the world. So when we say doing science, we have this image of people wearing white coats in the laboratory manipulating test tubes. Well, when I work in New Guinea observing birds, no, I don't have a white coat and I don't have test tubes. I'm using the scientific method, which means perceiving reality and trying to understand reality. Everybody needs to perceive reality and understand reality.
Because this is the only way to solve real problems, to live in reality and make decisions based in reality and in real facts.
That's right. If your view of the world is wrong, if you have an imaginary view of the world, if you think that smoking four packs of cigarettes a day is compatible with your health, then statistically, the odds are low that you will survive lung cancer for very long. That's just an example of how one has to perceive the world correctly in order to have a good chance of surviving in the world.
Another great scientist that we had on our show is Dr. Jane Goodall, who has famously been looked down upon for quite a while by the scientific community. In this case, for example, because, yeah, more old-fashioned academic experts said she humanized chimpanzees too much, or animals in general. You have been active, as we have talked about, in quite a few different academic fields and have written for the public, as did she. Did you ever experience anything like that? Academics taking you or your work not seriously for some reason? For example, I don't know, maybe they could say, why does this gallbladder guy, why doesn't he stop talking about these big geopolitical challenges of our time?
It's quite a coincidence that you raised Jane Goodall, because yesterday my wife and I went to a private discussion at the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History with Jane Goodall.
Wow.
Yeah. I met her previously and she talked about her career. So that provoked me into thinking about the parallels and differences between her career and my career. It's true that Jane got a lot of flack early on for many reasons, for being a woman, for anthropomorphizing, for giving her chimpanzees names rather than numbers. But she had the self-confidence to feel that whatever the Cambridge scientists were saying to her, she was right and they were wrong. And Jane, after the flack that she got in the 60s and 70s and early 80s about anthropomorphizing animals, today I think I don't know anyone who dumps on Jane Goodall. In contrast, I've gotten a lot more flack than has Jane Goodall, and the flack that I've gotten has carried on for a number of reasons. One is that my best-known book, Arnold Reich, Guns, Germs, Steel, is about why history turned out differently for different peoples. And Europeans generally, European people and European Americans instinctively believe that Europeans and Americans ended up as the richest people in the world. Why? Because they're the smartest. Well, I mentioned that when I went out to New Guinea, I went out naive, and it took me a day to realize, no, we're not smarter than they. If anything, they're smarter than us for understandable reasons, that in New Guinea, you got to be smart to survive, whereas in the United States, with medical care and with injections and inoculations, you don't have to be smart to survive. So there are still lots of people who get upset, on the one hand, when I say that New Guineans are at least as smart as Americans and Europeans. That's one source of flack that I get. Another source of flack that I get is that I do trespass on other fields of science. I am a gallbladder physiologist now, writing about anthropology and geography. There are anthropologists who get upset about that. Also, anthropology is an ultra-liberal field with its own set of blinders, and I don't fit into those blinders.
You've mentioned New Guinea quite a few times now. I believe your first field trip to that place took place in 1964. Is that correct?
That's true.
Yeah, okay. And since then, you have taken dozens of trips there. I think maybe more than 30, if I'm remembering that correctly. If somebody brings up New Guinea to you today, what do you see or feel? What are your first associations?
Well, at a distance, when I'm not there in the jungle with the leeches crawling over me and with mosquitoes biting me and itching from all these scrub mite bites, when I'm not there and I think about New Guinea at a distance, I think of it as the most beautiful, fascinating place in the world. New Guinea is a microcosm. It's on the equator, but it rises to 5,000 meters, 16,500 feet. And so New Guinea is one of the three places in the world that you have glaciers on the equator, glaciated mountains. The only other places are the Andes of South America and Mount Kilimanjaro. So in New Guinea, you have everything from tropical rainforest and coral reefs up to beech forest and oak forest and alpine grassland, and then the ski slopes, and finally the glaciers. New Guinea is a microcosm of the world. And then New Guinea has the world's most interesting, beautiful, fascinating birds. And New Guinea has New Guineans, 1,000 tribes with 1,000 languages, and they're all different from each other. And they're very interesting people. So at a distance, when I'm not scratching myself, I think of New Guinea as the most beautiful, fascinating place in the world.
Yeah, I remember you saying in another interview that basically the only disadvantage of working in New Guinea is that after New Guinea, the rest of the world is pretty gray and boring.
That's true. By comparison, the rest of the world is boring.
Yeah. You mentioned that in hindsight, remembering it from the comfort of your home here in LA, it's really exciting and beautiful to see all these visuals in front of your inner eye. But how was it for you personally to actually spend all this time up, for example, in the mountain jungles of such a remote region, and living with hunter-gatherers?
First, I should mention that most New Guineans are farmers rather than hunter-gatherers.
Yes.
But in any case, what is it like to be there? It's a mixture of fascination and frustration and discomfort. The fascination is the fascination of the birds, the 600 species, and they're all different. The fascination of New Guineans being in camp, in a jungle camp with New Guineans, where it's it's either I alone and the New Guineans, or I and an Australian friend of mine and the New Guineans. And they're really interesting people, and they're different. I have a lot to learn from them. Being in New Guinea is frustrating because things go wrong. There are always things that go wrong. If you're out in the jungle and if you haven't taken enough toilet paper with you, you don't go down to the neighboring store and get more toilet paper. That's just an example of a mild example of things that go wrong in New Guinea. And then it's uncomfortable. Routinely, it's uncomfortable. When I'm out there, here I can say how beautiful it is. The fact is that when I'm in New Guinea, most of the time I'm worried about what's going to happen tomorrow. And occasionally there's 10 minutes at the end of the day where I can sit at the edge of the ridge at the end of the camp and look out and say, my God, that's beautiful. But then the following day, I'm always thinking about what's going to go wrong. Will the people in camp desert me? Will we have enough food? And will my skin ulcer break out? And how will I find the birds and my boots? They're so muddy. So it's this mixture of fascination and frustration and discomfort.
How did you communicate with the tribes? You said that you had quite a bit to learn from them, even though you are a very well-traveled scholar.
There are three languages that I've used out there because I love learning languages. And I already had in Finland the experience of learning a language, not from books and dictionaries, but just by talking to people. When I arrived in New Guinea, the first New Guinea tribe that I arrived at, the Foray tribe, there wasn't a dictionary, there wasn't a grammar. I simply talked. I was with New Guineans and I repeated words. I got them to explain things to me. So I picked up enough Foray language to communicate in a rudimentary way. But then after 1 month, from the Foray area, we moved 60 miles to the Gimi area. I discovered that we had gone through five language groups, and now I was in the Gimi area. And I read, Jared, you can't learn a new language every month. So Foray is the only New Guinea language that I've learned anything of. Instead, in Papua New Guinea, the lingua franca is a Creole language called Tok Pisin. And it was pretty easy to learn Tok Pisin. In Indonesian New Guinea, the lingua franca is the Indonesian language. And I've learned enough Indonesian so that all my conversation with New Guineans in Indonesian New Guinea is all in the Indonesian language.
I'm sure there's quite a lot. And I also know that you've written extensively on it. But could you give us a few examples of what the New Guineans were able to teach you or what you felt inspired by when you observed and learned it?
So many things. To begin with birds, the traditional New Guineans who spend lots of time out in the forest and depend on the forest for much of their food, but also for their decorations. They don't have binoculars and they don't have tape recorders, but they're walking encyclopedias of knowledge about birds. So when I'm walking in the jungle with New Guineans, we're constantly chattering about birds. This bird does this, that bird does that. We're constantly chattering about our lives. They'll ask me, how many wives do you have? How many pigs do you have? How many children do you have? How much did you pay for your wife? So I'm talking with them and learning about their lifestyle. Other things that I've learned from New Guinea, naturally their attitude towards danger. I think we can get on towards talking about danger. And then bringing up children. When my wife and I, when our children were born, just short of my 50th birthday, my wife had thought a lot about children. I had never thought about children. And when our children were born, I hadn't paid attention to bringing up children in the United States. My model for bringing up children was what I had seen in New Guinea. And so I brought up my children like New Guinea children, namely, give them as much freedom as possible, let them do what they want, let them make their decisions, as long as they don't kill themselves. And
how did that turn out?
Well, it turned out that one of our sons at age 3 fell in love. The first time he saw a snake, it was love at first sight. And because in New Guinea, you let children do things that aren't going to kill them. Yes, my wife and I bought him a snake. We didn't get him a poisonous snake, but we let him get snakes and catch frogs. So we ended up with 146 pet frogs and snakes and lizards in the house. And so he still has a pet turtle, but then he got interested in cooking, so he became a chef. My other son, when I took him on trips in order to have some private time with twins, a problem with being the father of twins is that if they're same-sex twins, two boys, they're so tightly bonded to each other that I had to go to real effort to have some private time with my sons. So each son, I took on, say, 6 trips a year, and I had to figure out what interested them. Max, I took to places where he could see and catch frogs and snakes. Joshua, I discovered he was interested in military history. So I took him to Civil War battlefields in the U.S. Southeast, with the result that he ended up going to university, Duke, in the U.S. Southeast.
That's great to see the fruits of following that philosophy that you've learned over there. And another thing that you mentioned, learning from the New Guineans, is something about danger. I believe they are assessing risk in a quite a different way than you did when you came there.
In New Guinea, if you make a mistake, you cannot repair the mistake in the easy ways that we do in the West. For example, when I was at college, I slipped on the ice and I sprained my ankle. I limped over to a telephone. I called up my physician father. Dad drove over 6 miles, picked me up, took me to get my ankle fixed. That's just an example that if things go wrong in the United States, you can generally fix them. If things go wrong in New Guinea and you're out in the jungle, generally you cannot fix them. And the result is that New Guineans, they end up scarred and they end up often losing limbs or losing hands or losing the ability to move. Initially, when I went out there, I had the macho American belief, I'm indestructible, I'm young, I'm tough. Fear of danger, that's something for my old worried parents, but it's not something for me. And it took a number of bad experiences for me to realize that, Jared, if you keep this up, you're going to be dead in short order. And so I learned from New Guineans always to think of what can go wrong and always to prepare for what can go wrong. It drives my friends crazy. It drives my wife and children crazy that daddy is always thinking of what can go wrong. But I've learned the hard way that if you don't think of what can go wrong, when something goes wrong, you'll be in trouble.
But isn't it also terribly exhausting to always think about all the things that could go wrong?
It's more exhausting not to think about them and then have to deal with it when it happens.
That's a good comeback. Yeah, I mean, you give many examples in your speeches and your books that make that point clear. I remember that you also talk about the fact that when it was time to look for a place to sleep at night, you felt, well, you know, let's get some cover, let's sleep under a tree. While they pointed out, well, that's kind of a bad idea because branches could break and kill you. And you thought, that's a valid theoretical point, but how likely is it really? Maybe 1 in 1,000. But then they point out, yeah, but we are sleeping here every night. So if we take that risk every night, after 1,000 nights, we'll be hit by a branch probably. So that also shows that these kind of risk assessments, they're also kind of relative to the situations we find ourselves in on a daily basis.
That's right. The essential point of what you're saying is that if you do something that each time you do it, there is a low probability, 1 in 1,000, 1 in 100, of something going wrong. And if you're going to do it 1,000 times, it will catch up with you. And so if you sleep under a dead tree, as I was prepared to do in 1966, I looked up at that giant tree and the New Guinean said, that tree is dead. I thought, for heaven's sakes, yes, it's dead, but it's been there for years and it'll stay there for decades. But when you sleep in the jungle at night, every night in the jungle, you hear a few times at night a crash where a tree falls in the jungle. And eventually, it's not that the New Guineans did the statistics. I did the statistics. If you sleep under a dead tree, which has a 1 in 1,000 chance of falling on you, and if you're going to spend 3 years out in the jungle, 3 times 365, well, that's not quite right. But statistically, in 3 years, you're going to be dead. And that was just a warning to me that if you're going to do repeatedly something that is dangerous, each time, once you get away with it, but if you repeat it, you're not going to get away with it. And so nowadays, they say that once you get past age 70, one of the most dangerous things in life is to walk downstairs not holding the banister. Dozens of times a day, I go up and down the stairs. And each time, the chance of falling is low. But the majority of my friends in their 70s and 80s, more than half of them have had falls that either ended their lives or crippled them or put them out of commission for a year. And so I hold the banister when I go up and down stairs.
Despite your precautions there, did you end up in really dangerous situations in New Guinea?
Repeatedly, yeah. The one that was most of a learning experience for me was a boat accident where I got into a boat to go from an airport on an offshore island to the mainland. And it was a motorized canoe with a canopy over it, driven by young men, cocky young men, who drove off the canoe too fast into waves. Those of us as passengers shouted for them to slow down. They didn't slow down. The canoe tipped. It capsized. There we were trapped under the canopy. Well, we managed to get out. And this was in the mid-afternoon. We could see the mainland. It was only a few miles away, but there were waves. There were only three life preservers, and the crew took the life preservers. And the boat, the canoe, had a round bottom, so it was difficult to grip the canoe. I was on the bottom of the canoe, and as the afternoon went on and the sun fell lower and lower, the New Guineans with me on the canoe said, if we're not picked up by sunset, we're not going to get through the night. Fortunately, a small sailing canoe came past and spotted, two sailing canoes came past. One came past and picked up a couple of people in the boat. A couple of the people, New Guineans, got into that first sailing canoe. A second sailing canoe came past and I and a friend of mine got into the second sailing canoe. We headed off to the mainland now in the dark. As we got on, we could hear, after a while, we heard screaming. What had happened was the first sailing canoe had capsized because the weight was too much. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't pick them up because otherwise we would capsize. And we got to shore at night. But if we had not been picked up 15 minutes before sunset, I would not be talking with you. And yet the next day, I climbed to the roof of the house to look out and watch the sunset and to recreate what it was like to be on that canoe in the sunset. And when I came down and I realized it had gotten dark in 15 to 30 minutes, no boat coming past would have seen us. We had to have been picked up in those 15 minutes or we would never have been picked up. But I ran into an American biologist who said, I saw that canoe and I saw those cocky young men. And I told myself, they're incautious, they're dangerous. I said, this guy, Bill, I did not get into that canoe. And I realized until then I'd been saying it was their fault. But when I heard Bill say that, I realized, Jared, it was your fault. You were the one who got into that canoe. If you hadn't gotten into that canoe, you wouldn't have gone through this awful experience and nearly ended up dead. So I learned from that to take responsibility for assessing danger myself. So that was a learning experience, but there were a lot of other close calls.
And a scary one at that. What happened to the team of the first sailing boat, the one that's capsized?
The one that capsized, I'm sure they ended up dead.
Wow.
Because it was after dark, and the sailing canoe had a very low freeboard. It was close to water. It capsized. And to be out there at night, I never heard anything further about them.
Well, that changed, as you already talked about, your assessment of dangers and risks. We talked about it. I believe you call that the approach that you have chosen for yourself to worry about things that could go wrong, a constructive paranoia. Is this an approach that is mainly helpful for specific dangerous situations like that? Or do you think we can and maybe even should apply it to other dimensions and topics and challenges?
I recommend it to everyone. Every time you get into a car, that's dangerous. Every time you walk on the street, that's dangerous. Every time you eat food, that's dangerous. Everything you do in life is dangerous. So I've never choked on food until half a year ago. Fortunately, my wife was there. All of us eat food every day. But it took me until age 83 to appreciate the risks of choking on food. I'm more careful about chewing my food now.
But how far do you carry that approach? Because, I mean, there cannot be any total safety or security. And if you would attempt to really lower the risks in everything you do, then I think it's also safe to say you shouldn't go to New Guinea, for example.
Many people think, yes, Jared, you must be paralyzed with fear and caution. No, I'm not paralyzed. I still go to New Guinea. But I'm careful in New Guinea. I still drive cars. I'm careful when I drive cars. I still go up and down staircases. I'm careful when I go up and down. I live a full life. I'm not paralyzed. I'm just careful.
Okay, that's good to know. But what about if we're talking about this, what was it called? Paranoia, this constructive paranoia, that was the term. Can we also apply that to challenges that are bigger than ourselves? For example, we talked about briefly about climate change earlier on.
Well, constructive paranoia. Fortunately, the world doesn't have to think of very subtle dangers that might or might not materialize, such as a canoe capsizing. Instead, the dangers that the world faces are big, obvious dangers staring us in the face. They are, of course, climate change. They are the nuclear risk, which is in the background as we think of the situation in the Ukraine. There is the risk of depletion of world resources, running out of fish, running out of forests, running out even of fresh water. And they're the consequences of inequality around the world. Now, in this era of globalization, poor people in desperately poor countries, 50 years ago, people in rich countries didn't care what people in poor countries thought because they couldn't do anything about it. But now in this globalized world, people in poor countries, they can become terrorists. They can support terrorists. The terrorists have operated in Switzerland. They've operated in Belgium. They've operated in Britain. They've operated in the United States. They operate everywhere. So those are the dangers. They're not subtle dangers, like whether or not a tree will fall you. They're obvious dangers. Now in California, we're in the middle of climate change in California.
Yeah, I believe one of the fires in the past years got pretty close to your home, right?
Only half a mile away.
Yeah, well, that makes it real. That makes that danger real for sure. It's not subtle at all. There's a YouTube video from Think Big in which you talk about the main challenges that are facing the world from your perspective. And you just mentioned them. Let me reiterate them. It's a nuclear war. It's a climate change. It's the depletion of or the overuse of natural resources. And it's inequality. Did I get that right?
Correct.
Okay, yes. And it's interesting to see and to browse through the comments under this video. And I've brought a few for you. These are real comments from that video in which you talk about these challenges. And if you don't mind this little fun exercise, I will copy them into our little Zoom session for you to read. Maybe you can, if you don't mind, read them out loud and briefly comment on them. This would be the first one.
The fifth top crisis is political leadership that ignores the first four. Well, after those four crises, that hardly exists, hardly exhausts the list of other crises facing the world. And yes, political leadership could solve these four crises, and political leadership could fail to solve these crises. But it's not just political leadership to blame, it's also we the voters to blame. In the United States, the highest turnout that any presidential election ever got in the United States was 70% for, was it the, perhaps the most recent election?
Yes, Biden and Trump got the record numbers, still not that huge in numbers.
70%, before yeah. It was 60%. Mm-hmm. In Indonesia, with little experience of democracy, the first democratic election that Indonesia had, 93% of Indonesians turned out. In Belgium and Australia, 93, in Italy, the turnout in Italy is always between 85 and 90%. Here in Los Angeles, the turnout for mayor of Los Angeles, one of the most powerful urban positions in the United States, turnout is never more than 20%. If we have bad political leadership in the United States, we deserve it because we Americans can't be bothered to vote.
That's an important point, the responsibility we all share as citizens. Let me show you the second comment.
I still think that the ongoing mass extinction is the greatest risk. Climate change is just one. The ongoing mass extinction refers to the rate at which plant and animal species are going extinct and the prospects that within a century, maybe half of plant and animal species will go extinct. Yes, that's another major risk, and there certainly are people who would argue that that belongs to be placed up there with the other four risks. I would not argue about that. There are certainly more risks than the four risks that I mentioned. People will stop listening once I get beyond four. If you're willing to listen beyond four, yes, I'll talk about mass extinctions and political leadership.
Okay, we have two more comments.
Love Jared Diamond, respectable list, although I think nukes are overrated. Even a few bombs between, well...
I think maybe you don't see the whole sentence. I will just read the rest of it. Even a few bombs between countries will do no more than teach us a lesson and the losing of some arable land. The other three of Jared's list are on the money, though.
A few bombs between countries. It is unlikely that any countries would exchange a few bombs and stop there. Instead, those countries that have nuclear weapons, and there are, what, seven countries known to have nuclear weapons and at least one more that is well known to have nuclear weapons. If India and Pakistan, or if Russia and the United States lobbed a few nuclear weapons at each other, we wouldn't stop at lobbing just a few nuclear weapons. We would unload our arsenal in the hope of wiping out much of the arsenal of the other country. But even if just India and Pakistan, with smaller arsenals than the United States and Russia and China, if just India and Pakistan exchanged the 150 nuclear weapons that each of them has, then that would release enough soot into the atmosphere to produce what's called a nuclear winter. It would suffice to either to kill us all or to end the first world lifestyle for us all. So I do not see the prospect of any countries exchanging just a few nuclear weapons. It will either be the whole arsenal or nothing.
And the last comment of someone, again, who watched that video of you talking about these four big challenges. This was what this person felt like expressing.
We're blanked. You fill that in, and I'm an optimist.
I was wondering how you handled that. Yeah, we are fucked, and I'm an optimist.
I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
I would describe myself as a cautious optimist. By that, I mean, I don't think that the chances that we'll solve the world's problems are 95%. Instead, it's touch and go. I say that the chance that we will solve the world's major problems are 51%, and there are only 49% that we will mess them up. Why do I say it's 51% that will solve them rather than 49%? Well, the world's problems are all problems that we ourselves are causing. And so in order to solve these problems, all that we have to do is to stop causing them. We are the ones causing climate change. We are the ones causing resource depletion. We are the ones with the nuclear weapons. We are the ones who could reduce inequality. And all that we have to do to solve the problems is to deal with it. We know how to solve these problems. We know how to reduce or halt climate change just by reducing our energy consumption and burning less fossil fuels. It's that we don't choose to do so. So I'm cautiously optimistic we could, because we might choose to solve the world's problem. And I see signs of hope. Young people are more concerned about the world's problems than are older people. And big businesses that I used to hate and that many environmentalists used to hate and think of as the most destructive forces in the world, in the last 20 years, more and more big businesses like Walmart and even oil companies and Unilever, big businesses are taking environmental problems seriously because they realize it's bad for their business and it's also bad for the children and grandchildren of the CEO. So that big businesses are taking environmental problems seriously. Those are things that make me cautiously hopeful.
Yeah, cautiously hopeful. That's comforting to hear. At the same time, I have to say the perceived likelihood of 51% of success doesn't seem really high to me, given the fact that we are talking about a lot that's at stake here. Isn't that kind of sad or scary? I mean, you've studied the rise and fall of so many nations and cultures and civilizations and so on. For example, those that lived on islands and deforested every last part of it until they realized, and of course too late, that now it was impossible for them to continue to live on that island. And now we find ourselves potentially in the decisive time of our age, determining if we will continue to rise or fall. And this time, however, it's not about one society or one island, but we are talking about a global scale.
That's right. The risk that we face now is not of one society collapsing when the Easter Islanders or when the Maya of the most advanced Native American civilization, the Maya of the Yucatan and Guatemala and Honduras, when classic lone Maya civilization collapsed. That society collapsed, but nobody else in the world was affected by it or even knew about it. Whereas now in this globalized world, we don't have the luxury of just one society collapsing. We're interconnected. And so when things went wrong in Somalia or when things went wrong in Afghanistan, in went the American troops, and we could not solve Somalia's or Afghanistan's problems. So the risk we face is the risk of a global collapse. That's the cruel reality. What do we do about it? Sit here being paralyzed and depressed? Well, if you sit being paralyzed and depressed, you're not going to do anything about solving the world's problems. I think that our chances are 51%, so I'm not committing suicide now. I'm doing the best what I can do, which is to write books to motivate the world, to solve the world's problems, to make a better world for my children and their generation. If you choose to stay alive, and if you are cautiously optimistic, you have to make an effort to continue to be optimistic, because if you're not optimistic, if you come on as pessimistic, nobody's going to make an effort. If I tell people we're doomed, who on earth is going to make an effort to save the world if we're doomed? That's one thing. And the other thing is that in New Guinea, I've learned one of the lessons that I learned in New Guinea. Often in New Guinea, I was in dangerous situations where I thought I would not be alive the next day. And in New Guinea, I learned, I call it anesthetizing myself. When I'm in a life-threatening situation, I shut down my feelings and I deal with the situation the best I can. And then the next day I'll deal with my feelings. So there are people, my wife and many other people, they get very upset about the state of the world. And so I read the newspaper in the morning and that's it. I don't turn on television. I don't turn on the radio. I don't do anything in the evening because I would go to bed depressed. It's enough to read the newspaper in the morning.
You mentioned that you are sufficiently optimistic to, for example, write books with which you try to help fighting or meeting these challenges. And we talked about some of the big challenges or crises that are looming. And I think that is pretty much the topic of your most current book, which is called Upheaval. You talk about how to handle crisis in this book. What led you to write this book, and what is it about in your words?
Upheaval is about political crises, national crises, the world crisis, and how countries deal with national crises. There are two things that led me to write a book about national crises. One is that when I think back on the countries where I lived, all of them were going through or had gone through national crises. I was living in München on the day that the Berlin Wall was erected. I was living in Britain in the aftermath of World War II. I was living in Finland. My hosts in Finland were veterans of the Winter War. I was living in Chile a couple of years before the military coup of 1973 that nobody had foreseen. I was living in Indonesia, working in Indonesia in the aftermath of the Indonesian genocide. So the countries that I know best, the countries where I lived and worked, they've all gone through crises or they were in the middle of crises. My own country in the world is in a crisis today. That's one reason. The other reason for my writing the book was that my wife, Marie, is a clinical psychologist, and one of her specialties is crisis therapy. Crisis therapy is a branch of clinical psychology, which is different from the usual clinical psychology, which consists of helping people deal with long-term problems, where you've got the leisure to explore what happened to someone in childhood and the consequences of it. Instead, crisis therapy aims to help people who have a sudden crisis, typically the breakup of a relationship, the death of a loved one, getting fired from your job, a health setback, something that makes you feel that the world has gone wrong and your way of operating the world isn't working and you got to solve the problem fast, like within 6 weeks. Because if you don't solve it within 6 weeks, patients who come into a clinical psychologist's office and if they can't solve their problem fast, you know, there's the risk that they'll commit suicide. So Marie has a specialty in in crisis therapy. And Marie talked to me each week when she came home from her week's training in her crisis therapy center. She talked to me about the outcome predictors, about what people were likely going to solve their problems, what people were not likely to solve their problems. And as Marie talked about the outcome predictors, acknowledging that you got a problem, taking responsibility for solving the problem and not just blaming other people for it, figuring out what you have to change about yourself and what is okay and doesn't have to change, feeling strong from the crises that you've dealt with before. As Marie talked about those outcome predictors for personal crises, I realized that similar factors apply to national crises. Countries acknowledge or they refuse to acknowledge. Countries take responsibility or they refuse to take responsibility. Countries make selective changes. Germany has changed in tremendous respects since World War II. And in other respects, Germany is Germany. So the essence to dealing with a crisis is to figure out what about yourself as a person or what about your country is working well. Germany still has its support of the arts. That has not changed. German government has changed. Respect for education and Germans voting for educated politicians, unlike Americans, that has remained constant for 50, 60 years. So some things in Germany have changed and other things have not changed. In the United States, there are some things that we need to change and other things that I hope will keep in the United States. So that just illustrates that selective change and acknowledgement and taking responsibility are the essence of dealing with personal crisis, but they're also the essence of dealing with a national crisis and of dealing with the world crisis.
And you illustrate all of these points and even more predictors in different case studies and different kinds of chapters in the book. And one really fascinating chapter for me is the chapter on Finland and the Soviet Union. Some of the aspects that you mentioned are part of that story. I think a few more as well, such as maybe a national identity as a relevant factor for being able to deal with crisis. I would think the corresponding dimension with regard to personal crisis management might be, I don't know, the strength of the core of your personality. Would you talk about that chapter briefly? What is it about and why have you included it in the book?
Sure. In the case of Finland, the Scandinavian country of Finland, which in November 30, 1939, Finland, with a population of 3.5 million people, was invaded by the Soviet Union with a population of about 150 million. The situation seemed hopeless. The Finns fought their way to survival at a terrible cost. 100,000 Finns got killed. It was the largest child evacuation in world history. 50,000 Finnish children got evacuated to Sweden, but the Finns fought the Russians to a standstill and they retained their independence. After World War II, the Finns realized, if we have trouble with the Soviet Union again, nobody helped us in 1939, nobody's going to help us now, we have to deal with the Soviet Union. And so the Finns adopted what I would call constructive paranoia. The Finnish government, they have a committee which meets every month. And the charge of the committee is, think of everything that could go wrong and make a plan for it. I have a Finnish friend who's on that committee. And when Marie and I had dinner with that Finnish friend, that few weeks earlier, that Finnish friend's, the government committee, had talked about, what do we do in Finland if the electricity net gets knocked out? Another time, they talked about, what would they do if imports of fuel get cut off? What do we do if imports of foodstuffs get cut off? Naturally, 3 years previously, one of their monthly meetings was, what do we do if there's a pandemic? Well, they figured if there's a pandemic, maybe it's a respiratory pandemic, we better have face masks. So Finland bought 1 million face masks. And when COVID struck, Finland had its face masks. The United States did not have its face. The Finns have a plan for everything. They practice constructive paranoia on the national scale, just as I do on the personal scale. So that's one reason why I admire the Finns.
And that's probably also a reason why they have gotten along pretty well with Russia in the past years and decades, up to the Ukraine war at least, because based on these experiences in 39 and so on, in the Winter War, where they were able to withstand the overwhelming force of the Soviet Union, afterwards they took that geopolitical reality into consideration when making all these plans. And that for them meant that they have to be aware that there is a bigger, stronger nation next to them, neighboring with a big border, and they have to somehow deal with them while trying to remain independent. Is there something that the US policy towards Russia could or should learn from Finland's policies towards the Soviet Union and then Russia after 45? And I'm asking that, of course, also in the light of the current war in Ukraine and the current tension between all of these nations, not least of all between the US and Russia.
Sadly, yes, the United States could and should have learned from Finland's experience with the Soviet Union. At the end of World War II, the Finns concluded, we have to look out for our own safety and we have to keep good relations with the Soviet Union. We cannot stop talking with them. And so the Finnish government, ever since World War II, there are constant discussions with Soviet Union and now Russia at every level. The president and prime minister meet. There are discussions at every level about everything, with the result that the Russians knew well what the Finnish were thinking and planning about everything. The Russians were not suspicious that the Finns would pull any surprises on them. The United States, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and I've heard this from a Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense for the United States, who regretted that after the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States took Russia for granted, and we did not have constant discussions with Russia because we mistakenly thought the Soviet Union is gone as a risk. And we made, in retrospect, the strategic mistake of expanding NATO to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Well, that really scares the Russians. We would have been scared if the Russians had, well, we were scared when the Russians had their relationship with Cuba. So the United States has taken Russia for granted in the way that the Finns learned not to take Russia for granted. I don't know whether the Ukraine also took Russia for granted. In retrospect, there's nothing one can do about it. But I just wonder whether the Ukraine might have avoided their problems with Russia if they had not talked about joining NATO and if they had not talked about possibly joining the EU and if they had had constant discussions with Russia.
One similarity between Russia and Ukraine that, of course, also is pretty apparent is the fact that both countries, to everybody's surprise, were able to withstand Soviet Union and then Russian aggression. Of course, we don't know yet how the war in Ukraine will end, but it seems like they also surprised most experts by their strength in defense, which probably also has a lot to do with a national identity and many other factors that you write in the book. I don't think we have time to get into all of it, but I just want to indicate that for any of our listeners who want to really strengthen their understanding of all these complex relations between nations throughout history, I really, really highly recommend reading your book, Upheaval. Of course, we only have the time right now to touch upon it lightly, to give a little glimpse into it. And to conclude our conversation, I would like to return for the last few minutes onto the global scale and to ask you, when we talk about big global crises like climate change and the overuse of natural resources, inequality, etc., based on your extensive research on historic societies, what would failure to meet these challenges look like?
What would failure look like? In the worst case, it would look like an exchange of nuclear arsenals and no people left alive. In the next worst case, it would be an exchange of nuclear arsenals and people left alive, but the end of first world civilization, and the people who would be left would be my New Guinea friends because they've been used stone tools recently. They remember how to make the stone tools. I don't know how to make stone tools, and Europeans and Americans don't. Those are worst case scenarios. Other worst case scenarios are depletion of world resources, widespread famine, widespread starvation, more wars because of inequality. That's what failure to deal with world's problems would look like. As for what success in dealing with the world's problems would look like, success would mean that we've gotten onto a sustainable economy. We're harvesting fish and forests and fresh water at the same rate at which they're getting replenished. And a sustainable economy means that we can go on forever for the lives of my children, my grandchildren, great and great great grandchildren. Sustainable economy would mean that we have a bright future ahead of us, that we've reduced inequality between countries, because the world is not going to be a stable world as long as there are poor countries and rich countries. And we Americans have learned from the Twin Towers attack that poor countries nowadays have ways of visiting their rage on rich countries. So what the world would look like if we've solved the world's problems would be a sustainable equality, sustainable economy with much more equality between countries than we have at present.
We mentioned briefly in passing that historically, to meet big challenges successfully, one of the important factors was a national identity. Can we find that on a global scale? It seems to me like to meet these challenges that you talk about, these big four challenges, not even talking about all the other ones, we need this kind of shared identity on a global scale, which is something I absolutely don't see right now.
Give thanks to COVID, because COVID, for the first time in world history, we have an acknowledged global problem requiring a global solution. The closest we came to it was the flu at the end of World War I, but that spread too slowly and it did not galvanize a world effort. But COVID, it spread so rapidly, it is clear that no country can protect itself against COVID unless the whole world is safe against COVID. New Zealand tried, Australia tried, Vietnam tried, China tried. They all try to eliminate COVID within their borders. They couldn't do it. Why? Because their borders are permeable. No country is going to be safe against COVID until the whole world is safe against COVID. Similarly, climate change. There's no way that Germany can protect itself against climate change by reducing its consumption of fossil fuel and thereby reducing carbon dioxide levels over Germany, because the atmosphere over Germany is mixed with the atmosphere over Poland and Africa. And so climate change is a global problem requiring a global solution. My hope is that COVID is a potent teacher. COVID kills people quickly and unequivocally. Climate change kills people slowly and ambiguously. If you die of climate change, you don't say, my mother died of climate change. You say, my mother died of that tsunami or famine or whatever. But the tsunami and famine were the result of global climate change. So my hope is that COVID will drive home the lesson that global problems will require global solutions. And we're in the process of kicking and screaming, working out a global solution to COVID by somewhat spreading vaccines around the world, not nearly enough, but there's some of it. And once we've learned the lesson from COVID, my hope is that we'll learn the lesson also for climate change and these other global problems that require a global solution.
And I think the good news is that to find these global solutions and to collaborate doesn't mean that we all need to be best friends in general. It's also possible to be opponents and still collaborate as long as there's some overlap in our interests. And in the book, you have one seemingly small story, an example for the collaboration between two bitter enemies, which is Israel and Lebanon. And finally, you are a bird fan. It's about bird watching. Would you mind telling us this example?
Sure. Israel and Lebanon. It's hard to think of two countries with more justified grounds for hating each other when rockets are lobbed into Israel from neighboring countries, including Lebanon, and when Israel, conversely, had made a massive invasion of Lebanon. But nevertheless, in these two countries, they're on a migration pathway of birds from Europe in the fall migrate south through Lebanon to Israel into Africa. And then in the spring, birds migrate north from Africa through Israel into Lebanon. The major cause of aircraft crashes in both Israel and Lebanon is collisions with large migratory birds. The major cause of the downing of Israeli fighter aircraft is collisions with pelicans and cranes and these migratory birds. So Israeli and Lebanese bird watchers gradually, took years to do it, worked out an arrangement whereby in the spring, when the birds are migrating north, the Israeli bird watchers call up the Lebanese bird watchers and say, there's a big flock of pelicans and they'll be across your border 45 minutes from now. ground your, and the Lebanese then ground their aircraft. And conversely, in the fall, when the birds are moving south, the Lebanese tell the Israelis, there's a flock of cranes in your direction. And the Israelis then ground their aircraft. Well, if Israel and Lebanon, with those intense reasons for hatred, can do this, China and the United States can do this. China and the United States do have grounds for competition. We have economic competition. There's military unease. But the United States and China both face climate change. The United States cannot solve climate change without the collaboration of the Chinese. The five countries that account for 62% of greenhouse gases in the world are the United States, China, Japan, India, and the European Union. And if those five entities, China and the United States and the other three, would make an agreement for dealing with climate change, there's 62% of greenhouse gases taken care of. And once China and the United States and India and European Union and Japan do it, then they can pressure the other 38% of countries economically to doing it. So that's another reason why I'm cautiously optimistic. If China and the United States would look out for their own self-interest, look themselves in the face and realize we got to solve climate change together.
We talked about your best decades probably being your 70s. You are now in your 80s and, as far as I can tell, still pretty active in your career. What do you do to stay curious and fit?
I'm interested in so many things. I'm still writing books. I'm still teaching at my university, University of California at Los Angeles. I believe that I'm the longest serving faculty member at UCLA. I came in 1966, and so I've just completed my 56th year of teaching. What else do I do? I take bird walks several days a week. I took a bird walk this morning. I still play the piano. I have a wonderful cellist who's around the corner, and she and I are working up. We just worked up the two Brahms cello sonatas. We're working up the Schubert piano and arpeggioni sonata. And I have dinner with my wife and talk with my wife every day. And one of my two sons comes over twice a week. And I read Italian, my second best foreign language. Every day I read some Italian. And once a week I have a two-hour conversation with an Italian friend in Los Angeles. So there are all these things that I do to keep active.
Is there something at this point of your life that you are really curious about and that you would love to learn more about or that you would love to experience that you haven't yet?
Yes, Johann Sebastian Bach wrote 221 church cantatas, and most of them are wonderful. I've sung in maybe 20 of them. There are some of them that I know well, but there are dozens and dozens of Bach church cantatas that I don't know well. Whenever I retire at UCLA, one of the things that I want to devote myself to in life is getting to know those 221 Bach church cantatas. If I do it one a week, that'll be 4 years.
That sounds like a plan to me. Well, it's great to hear that you won't run out of stuff to do, to read, to experience in the next few years. And I wish you all the best for that. And I thank you so much for your generous time and for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have this discussion with you. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Das war Jared Diamond bei Weltwach. Ich freue mich sehr, dass wir ihn für dieses Gespräch gewinnen konnten. Ich hoffe, ihr konntet einiges daraus für euch ziehen an Erkenntnissen, an Gedanken, an Impulsen und würde mich natürlich freuen, wenn ihr uns das wissen lasst, ob zum Beispiel via Instagram als Kommentar zum Post dieser Folge oder natürlich wie immer gern auch in der Podcast-App eurer Wahl, zum Beispiel bei Spotify oder auch in der Apple Podcast-App via Rezension und Sternebewertung. Ihr wisst ja, das hilft uns, von anderen potenziellen Hörerinnen und Hörern gefunden zu werden. Ihr würdet uns damit also einen großen Gefallen tun. Lieben Dank, macht es gut und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.